Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. This Friday, President Obama will officially hand over the U.S. government to Donald Trump. This week, leading up to his last day of his presidency, we will look at President Obama's legacy and talk about what powers he is leaving for Trump. And we're kicking off this series by focusing on U.S. foreign policy. President Obama has been praised for signing the nuclear deal with Iran and normalizing relations with Cuba. But as he leaves office, violence in Afghanistan is on the rise, Iraq is mired in a deadly war with ISIS and sectarian conflicts. The civil war in Syria has killed over 500,000 people and has displaced millions. And the U.S.-backed Saudi war in Yemen has devastated the poorest country in the Middle East, leaving a trail of death and destruction. Today, the Obama administration is overseeing the bombing campaigns in six countries. Before taking office in 2008, he vowed to end the two major wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. In May of 2013, he noted, quote, "Our systematic effort to dismantle terrorist organizations must continue, but this war, like all wars, must end. That is what history advises. It is what our democracy demands," end quote. So what was President Obama's foreign policy doctrine, and what is he leaving behind? To discuss these issues, we are joined today by two guests. Andrew Bacevich is professor of international relations and history at Boston University and one of the leading advocates of non-interventionist approaches to U.S. foreign policy. Andrew Bacevich is the author of many books, including his most recent, America's War for the Greater Middle East, A Military History. Andrew served in the Army for 23 years and retired at the rank of colonel, and he was an early critic of the U.S. invasion of Iraq. Hi, Andrew. Welcome back to the show.
Well, thanks very much.
Nice to have you. We're also joined today by Stephen Walt, the Robert and Renee Belfer Professor of International Affairs at the Harvard Kennedy School of Government. Stephen Walt is also author of several books, including The Israel Lobby and U.S. Foreign Policy, which he co-authored with John Mearsheimer. Hi, Stephen. Welcome back to the show.
Nice to be with you.
Great to have you. Well, this is a huge topic, and there's an article in The Guardian that was written by Code Pink's Medea Benjamin, and the headline really says it all. America dropped 26,171 bombs in 2016. The Council on Foreign Relations added up the Defense Department's data on airstrikes and found that the Obama administration, every day last year, the military blasted combatants or civilians with 72 bombs. That is three bombs every hour. And I wanted to ask you both a question about power. Andrew Bacevich, let's start off with you. You served in the military. How much power does a president have to really take on the military-industrial complex?
Well, I think pretty limited. President Obama gave an interview, or actually a series of interviews, a few months ago to Jeffrey Goldberg, for The Atlantic, and one of the things he said in the course of that interview, one of the things he made reference to was what he called the blob, and he also referred to what he called a Washington playbook, and his comments, I think, were reflecting his appreciation, gained over the course of almost 8 years, that the foreign policy establishment, that apparatus, that bureaucracy, is committed to a set of routines that have been in place for decades now, basically since the beginning of the Cold War, and that apparatus is exceedingly reluctant to give up on those routines. So President Obama made some pretty notable changes in the in U.S. national security policy in the sense that he abandoned the George W. Bush administration's emphasis on using large-scale U.S. forces, invading and occupying countries with expectations of changing them. That said, by no means did Obama turn out to be a pacifist. He simply amended the way that the United States is using force, particularly in the Islamic world, probably reduce the costs that we ourselves have sustained in terms of Americans being killed and American dollars being wasted. But he did that without achieving results any better than those of the George W. Bush administration, as your initial review of his record indicated.
Stephan, how would you answer that question? And you think about what happened when President Obama came to the White House and the Democrats controlled the House and the Senate. But, you know, you have to wonder, and this doesn't really get much attention in the national dialogue, how much power did Obama have to really take on the military and the military-industrial complex? Because he's sold more weapons than any president since World War II, and then this his record on bombing that I just noted in the intro that came from the Council on Foreign Relations. How much could he have really changed?
Well, we don't know because he didn't really try. And Andrew's already indicated what some of the constraints on him were. I wanted to highlight another one. You know, Donald Rumsfeld, back when he was Secretary of Defense, once quipped that you go to war with the army you have. And in a sense, Obama had to go and conduct foreign policy with the foreign policy establishment that he had. And that includes the foreign policy establishment within the Democratic Party. In many respects, I see Obama as something of a tragic figure in that I think he actually did want to try and reorient how the United States engaged with the rest of the world. He understood that we were overcommitted. He understood that some of the tools that the Bush administration had been using weren't producing results and were actually leaving the United States worse off. The difficulty he had is that virtually the entire Democratic Party foreign policy establishment, not just the Republicans, were also deeply committed to a policy of American primacy, a policy where the United States is seen as the indispensable nation that has to take the lead in solving almost every global problem. And this is also an establishment that's very prone to take the one tool the United States has in spades, namely military force, and use it in a variety of ways, often telling ourselves that we're doing this for the very best reasons, for really idealistic motives, to spread democracy, to liberate countries, to deal with terrorism. The point is that he didn't appoint anybody who really challenged that consensus. Most of the people that were part of his administration, for example, had supported the Iraq War in 2003, and that includes, of course, Hillary Clinton, but also plenty of other people within his administration. So I think, you know, when he took office, he did want to try and shift the focus of American foreign policy, but he essentially had no one on his team to help him do that, and he never made an explicit attempt to try and really reorient how Americans think about their engagement in the world, what our vital interests really are, and what are the appropriate tools that might advance our interests but also be better for other parts of the world.
Well, you make a good point about the Democrats' views and how they don't really differ much with Republicans on this issue, because in December, President Obama signed the 2017 military budget, $619 billion. And he has pointed out on a few occasions that the U.S. spends more than on the military budget more than the next seven countries combined. And when you look at the Senate vote, again, this was in December, you had 92 voting yes and seven voting no, two Republicans and five Democrats. So what about that point, Andrew Bacevich?
Well, I think the vote is suggestive of this consensus that Steve Walt just described exceedingly well, the commitment to American primacy, to the notion of American exceptionalism, and so on. I think that the evidence is clear. You know, I agree with Steve that Obama is kind of a tragic figure, but I think it's also true that when Obama became president, he was a novice when it came to statecraft, and I think somehow he imagined that if he gave a few speeches, recall the famous speech in Cairo in his first year in office when he promised a new beginning in U.S. relations with the Muslim world. He was naive and frankly had no concrete understanding of what steps would have to be undertaken in order to bring about the change that certainly informed the expectations about his administration at the very outset. My own sense is that he's a very smart man, and I think over the course of his 8 years, he has evolved a very sophisticated understanding of the way the world works and an appreciation of the limits of American power. And I think also those then are in evidence. If we look at to the positive aspects of his foreign policy legacy, when we look to things like the Iran nuclear deal, the opening to Cuba, the Paris climate change deal, where he was a key promoter, we can see things that may not, as of yet, have produced broad positive results, but which at least have the potential over time to producing results that may indeed have a very meaningful and positive impact on the international order and on our place in the world. But that aspect of his legacy is incomplete, and it's going to take the passage of time to see if indeed those expectations are fulfilled.
Hmm. Andrew Bacevich, you often ask, what has been accomplished over the last 8 years? What has the, quote, war on terror really accomplished? What could Obama have done differently, realistically speaking?
Well, I mean, the war on terror has produced precious little. Obama, I think you alluded to this in your lead-in, you know, he promised to end the Iraq war responsibly. He promised to win the Afghanistan war. He has achieved neither of those objectives. We have seen over the course of his presidency, in a geographic sense, the global war on terror has expanded. The results are not any better than we got under Bush. Well, what's the problem? The problem here, I think, is, and this is the point that Steve Walt made, the problem here is that American military power, power wielded by outside powers, inserting itself into the heart of the Islamic world, is not going to solve the problem. So there are these fascinating statistics about the number of bombs that are being dropped, about the drone missions, about the assassination campaigns, and really all those are they are at least irrelevant to the problem at hand, and they're probably counterproductive. So the place to the beginning of wisdom, I think, is to acknowledge that U.S. military power cannot provide an antidote to the dysfunction that is present in many parts of the Islamic world. Only when we acknowledge that failure does it become possible then to begin envisioning an alternative approach to policy that can give us a different outcome. I'm not sure what Obama thinks on that specific question today, but sadly, as Steve Walt suggested, there is very little evidence that in either the Republican Party or the Democratic Party, or more broadly the national security establishment, that there are any significant figures who are willing to say out loud that U.S. military efforts in the Islamic world have failed and that failure is irrevocable.
Mm. Steve Walt, same question. What could Obama have done realistically?
Well, one obvious place to focus in is the decision he made in 2009 to escalate the war in Afghanistan. He came in, he had a couple of reviews, he was getting pressure from the military to send more troops to do a surge in Afghanistan, and after much deliberation he decided to go along with their advice, said it would be temporary, this would put Afghanistan on a different trajectory and then allow the United States to get out. And as a number of people pointed out at the time, this was not going to actually change anything. It was going to be perhaps tactically successful in the short term, but it wouldn't change the basic realities in Afghanistan. And unfortunately, that's turned out to be the case. We are in worse shape there than we were in 2009. The surge really had no real effect. Now, I think part of what was driving Obama back then was this fear, which many Democratic presidents have had, of being sort of attacked from the right, that they're going to be seen as insufficiently hawkish, they'll be accused of being McGovernites, and that this was Obama's way of insulating himself from that kind of pressure. And it worked politically very effectively. When he ran for re-election in 2012, Mitt Romney really could not attack him because Obama could claim that, you know, I got Osama bin Laden and I've got more drones going in various places. But this, I think, ultimately trapped the administration. On the one hand, Obama tried to persuade Americans that ISIS and other terrorist groups were really not that serious a problem. Right? He did try to downplay the perceived danger from terrorism. It's something we need to deal with, but not something we should panic over. But on the other hand, he justified decisions like escalating in Afghanistan by the need to deal with Al-Qaeda, the need to deal with the terror problem. And instead of basically saying the problem here is that the Arab and Islamic world is having an allergic reaction to the continued assertion of foreign military power, they have all sorts of internal problems of their own, and what Obama could have done, although it would have been politically controversial to do it, is simply say the only way to deal with this over the longer term is to disengage American military power from trying to run these societies, not try to do social engineering, understand that these parts of the world are going to have to learn how to govern themselves, possibly with some well-intentioned non-military advice and help from the United States and others, but going in there with the crudest instrument in our toolkit, which is namely our military, was not going to create effective political institutions in any of these places and was going to lead some small number of people in all of these places to be very angry at the United States, so angry that they would then join up with groups like ISIS or Al-Qaeda or others and look for ways to try and pay the United States or its allies back. He never quite made that conceptual breakthrough. He might not have been able to pull it off politically if he'd tried, but that, I think, is the only alternative approach that he could have taken from day one that would put us in a different situation now, 8 years later. Mm.
Steve Walt is the Robert and Renee Belfer Professor of International Affairs at the Harvard Kennedy School of Government. He's the author of The Israel Lobby and U.S. Foreign Policy, which he co-authored with John Mearsheimer. Andrew Bacevich is Professor of International Relations and History at Boston University. His latest book is America's War for the Greater Middle East, A Military History. Andrew served in the Army for 23 years and retired at the rank of colonel, and he was an early critic of the U.S. invasion of Iraq. This week, we are kicking off a week-long series looking at President Obama's legacy as he gets ready to hand over the U.S. government to Donald Trump. And today we are talking about foreign policy. What are your thoughts on President Obama's foreign policy legacy? He's been praised for signing the nuclear deal with Iran and normalizing relations with Cuba, but we've been talking about the violence that has continued in Afghanistan and Iraq. He has also authorized over 10 times more drone strikes than George W. Bush. And then later in the show, we'll be talking about the vast powers that he's leaving for Donald Trump. So what are your thoughts? How do you see President Obama's foreign policy legacy? And what's to come? If you have any questions, our guests today, Andrew Bacevich and Steve Walt, follow this, write about this. They follow it very closely. 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org or leave a comment on our Facebook or Twitter page. Let's talk about what happened in the aftermath of the Arab Spring. The U.S. backed the Gulf in suppressing the uprisings in many cases, backed the coup in Egypt, and then the military intervention in Libya completely destabilized the country. Andrew, can you talk about the Obama administration's response to that? And again, what would you or what do you think the administration should have done differently?
Well, I don't know that I can give you an adequate explanation for exactly why the Arab Spring occurred and the direction it would have followed had we not interfered as we did. I do believe that in the long run, U.S. interests would have been better served to state clearly and to be consistent in stating our support for those forces within those societies that were opposed to authoritarian rule and were calling for a democracy. What we in fact did, of course, was to be quite inconsistent. We ended up supporting the restoration of military government in Egypt. We supported the suppression of democratic forces in Bahrain, turning a blind eye to a Saudi intervention. And then, I think most catastrophically, we supported the intervention in Libya to overthrow Colonel Gaddafi, which then basically led to that country becoming the site of anarchy. So it's hard to give the Obama administration very high marks with regard to the response to the Arab Spring. But that said, if the criticism presumes that there could have been a set of U.S. actions in these various countries that somehow would have produced positive outcomes across the board, I think that that's naive and gives us too much credit for our inability to understand what was actually going on, and far too much credit to our ability to direct the course of events. We may be, as we say, the sole superpower, but we're not really in charge of the world, and the delusion that we're somehow in charge of the world ends up causing more mischief than it does to leading to positive outcomes.
So Steve, what would you add?
Well, I have a certain degree of sympathy for the administration in that a revolutionary upheaval like we saw throughout the Middle East is inherently unpredictable, fast-moving. You think one thing is going on, it turns out to cause reverberations elsewhere. So that would have been, I think, a challenge for any administration to figure out exactly how to steer the proper course there. I think as an overall strategy, we should have adopted essentially a policy of almost benevolent neglect or hands-off, say, look, we think the Arab and Islamic world ought to be moving in a more progressive, participatory direction, but we're not going to try to engineer that. We understand that these societies are going to have to work this out without for themselves. I do think the administration misinterpreted what was going on in a number of places. I think they quickly saw this as a sort of almost velvet revolutions of Eastern Europe moment where lots of would-be liberal Democrats were flowing out into the streets to get rid of a bunch of dictators. I think we now know that the various social and political forces in places like Egypt or in Syria or elsewhere were much more diverse, much more variegated, and many of them actually not necessarily groups we would want to promote. Because we misinterpreted, I think the United States did make a number of bad calls. Andrew has already mentioned our foolish decision to topple Gaddafi in Libya when, of course, we had no idea what would follow him. I think it was also a mistake to come out as quickly as we did in demanding that Assad must go in Syria, long before 500,000 people had been killed, long before the civil war was really going. The United States had basically declared we thought this government should leave without having asked ourselves the question, well, if Assad did go, what would be the ruling situation, what set of institutions would govern Syria? And of course, we kept wanting to support moderates there, the problem being that we couldn't find any, and the handful we could find were not particularly effective at competing for power there. So if you look back, I mean, the United States should have taken, I think, a much more hands-off approach to the entire upheaval going on there, not because we weren't concerned and not because we didn't have humanitarian objectives that we wanted to promote, but because we did not have the wisdom, the skill, the knowledge, or the tools to fine-tune what was going on in these societies and guarantee an outcome that we would be happy with. And if that's the case, then I think, first do no harm would have been a much better approach.
Steve Walt is professor of international affairs at the Harvard Kennedy School of Government, co-author of The Israel Lobby and U.S. Foreign Policy. And Andrew Bacevich is professor of international relations and history at Boston University and the author of America's War for the Greater Middle East, A Military History. Today, we are kicking off a week-long series looking at President Obama's legacy and the powers he's leaving for Donald Trump. And today, we're kicking it off by talking about foreign policy. This is Your Call, and we'll be back after this.
There are many ways you can take part in the conversation today on Your Call. You may call us on the telephone. You may send an email to feedback@yourcallradio.org. You may go to the yourcallradio.org website and leave a comment there. If you'd like to participate in today's show by telephone, well, the phone lines are filled up, but when somebody finishes their call, you may call us at 866-798-8255. You can also tweet us at Your Call Radio.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. This week, we are kicking off a series looking at President Obama's legacy and the powers he's leaving for Donald Trump. Tomorrow, we are going to talk about the economy and the financial crisis. Wednesday, we'll talk about the environment. And Thursday, we'll talk about immigration. Friday, it's Inauguration Day, and we're going to have a two-hour special. Our media roundtable will be looking at media coverage of President Obama as he leaves the White House and Donald Trump as he comes in. But we will also look at President Obama's legacy on his relationships with the media and really cracking down on the media. And then what's to come with Donald Trump? That's on Friday. If you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, we are talking about President Obama's foreign policy legacy with Andrew Bacevich, professor of international relations and history at Boston University. His latest book is America's War for the Greater Middle East, A Military History. Andrew Bacevich served in the Army for 23 years and retired at the rank of colonel, and he was an early critic of the U.S. invasion of Iraq. Steve Walt is professor of international affairs at the Harvard Kennedy School of Government. He is the author of, co-author of, The Israel Lobby and U.S. Foreign Policy. He wrote that book with John Mearsheimer. We've got a number of calls on the line, so let's kick it off with Vijay in Cupertino. Hi, Vijay. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, and thanks for taking my call. My question is, when I have observed various presidential governments come in, irrespective of whether they've been Democratic or Republican, there seems to be an irrational obsession with the politics of the Middle East. One can clearly see an interest in protecting Israel and what they do, some protection drivers in Saudi Arabia and the oil. I'm not sure why each and every president feel it's their responsibility to try to get envoys out of the Middle East and try to solve the problem. Is there something below the surface here which we do not understand?
Thank you for that. Steve, do you want to take that first?
Well, I think that the caller actually identified the two big motivations for American involvement in the Middle East. One is that we've got this special relationship with Israel, which is partly based on sort of idealistic motivations, but very much driven by domestic politics here in the United States. And that has pulled, you know, the last three American presidents, Clinton, Bush, and Obama, into spending endless hours dealing with various problems related to Israel. The second motivation has been energy and the fact that the world economy still runs to a large extent on oil and gas, and therefore America, since at least World War II, has cared a lot about preserving access to that. We may not have gone about that always in the smartest way, but I think those two motivations explain why the United States has been so involved there for decades. And then finally, after September 11th, of course, belief that, you know, the Middle East was the source of anti-American terrorism and that the only way to deal with it was for Americans to go there and in some way root it out. That was, you'll recall, part of the justification for going after Saddam Hussein, even though he had nothing to do with 9/11, the idea that we were now going to transform the Middle East to create a bunch of pro-American democracies using military force if necessary, and basically clean the whole place up so it wouldn't be a problem in the future. This was a delusional set of objectives, but I think if you add those three things together, the concern for energy, the special relationship with Israel, and then this belief that the United States had to go root out terrorism at the source, it explains why Americans have spent so much time, attention, bandwidth, and money and lives in that particular part of the world.
Steve, you co-wrote a book, The Israel Lobby and U.S. Foreign Policy, and last month President Obama committed to $38 billion in aid to Israel over the next 10 years. And then recently, this continues to get a lot of attention, the United States abstained from the U.N. resolution demanding an end to Israeli settlements. Why do you think President Obama took so long to do this?
I think he was reluctant to face the domestic political pressure that would come if he had taken a harsher line on Israel from the very beginning. I mean, I think Obama and then in the second term, Secretary of State John Kerry, both had Israel's long-term interests very much in mind. They were extremely supportive in terms of the aid they provided to Israel and the degree to which they were solicitous of Israeli concerns. And they worked enormously hard to try and advance a peace process, which they believe, and I think they're right here, is essential for Israel's long-term security and long-term safety. And they got nothing from the Netanyahu government in Israel for this. In fact, they got a lot of abuse instead. But I think you saw this final UN vote as essentially an almost symbolic act at the very end of the administration. Had they done something like that, you know, several years ago, say the beginning of the second term, it might have had an effect. And here I do fault Obama all along. I think he was naive about the ability to essentially persuade the Israeli government to go with a viable two-state solution, and he didn't understand that it would not happen absent pretty strong American pressure. That pressure was never really applied at any point in his 8 years, and that's why he was no more successful at achieving a two-state solution than George Bush was or than Bill Clinton was. He followed essentially the same playbook, and he got exactly the same results. And unfortunately, he ended up wasting an awful lot of time doing it as well.
Jewish Voice for Peace had a post on Facebook about settlements, and it says during Obama's presidency, 100,000 more Israeli settlers have moved into the West Bank. Andrew Bacevich, how would you answer that question about why every president is obsessed with the Middle East once they enter office?
Well, I think the factors that Steve named are correct. I think I would add a couple more. One of them has to do with the fact that our military involvement in the region, which predates 9/11 by a couple of decades, has been a bipartisan project. It's a project of the foreign policy establishment. The foreign policy establishment has been committed for decades now to the proposition that American military power, adroitly applied, can somehow fix things. And so that foreign policy establishment, Democrats, Republicans, the professional military, they are loath to acknowledge that this military project has failed, because for them to make that admission would in effect invite the question, well, why are you guys in charge? And why should we defer to the sort of wisdom that comes from those institutions, from think tanks, from the op-ed pages of newspapers like the Washington Post and the Wall Street Journal, all of whom over the years have been promoting this notion that there is an American-imposed military solution to the region. And then beyond that, if one would make that admission that our military efforts have failed, then certainly that immediately invites the question, well, then why are we spending $600+ billion a year on our military budget? I mean, what's the point? Where's the benefit? Yeah. So I think again the factors that Steve enunciated are correct. But there are even deeper reasons for this obsession. And I have to say, it seemed to me the implicit in the caller's question is the point that are there not other parts of the world that are actually more important to the well-being of the United States than the Islamic world, the Middle East? And the answer to that is, of course, yes. I mean, it's interesting the way our conversation, we're about, what, two-thirds of the way through this discussion of Obama's legacy, and all we have talked about is the Middle East. Even though I would argue that, for example, what happens in the Asia-Pacific today and over the course of the next several decades will have a far greater bearing on our security and our well-being than events that are happening in the region. And just as we have not talked about that part of the world, I'd argue that the attention of the foreign policy community more broadly focused on the Middle East gives too little attention to other things that are actually far more important.
Well, other parts of the country were definitely on our list. So since you brought that up, why don't you talk about the element of Obama's foreign policy in which he said he wanted to shift the focus from Europe and the Middle East toward East Asia and China. What are your thoughts on that?
My thoughts is, again, not unlike that speech that he made proposing a new start in U.S. relations to the Islamic world, good idea. Again, shift attention to the Asia-Pacific, good idea. But it really hasn't happened. I mean, it really hasn't manifested itself in very many meaningful ways. And I think that along with climate change, which I would sort of list as national security priority number one, I think that the whole question of finding a method to accommodate the reality of China's rise to the status of great power, that hasn't happened and needs to happen. And if we fail on that score, then the 21st century could well be just as disastrous as the 20th century is. And again, worrying about what happens in Syria or in Mosul is not particularly relevant to that larger question.
Well, I mean, Andrew, to be fair, the reason why I think it gets so much attention is because, I mean, so many Middle East correspondents say if the U.S. hadn't invaded Iraq, we probably wouldn't have this horrific disaster with ISIS.
And I agree.
And I know you're not
no
saying we shouldn't talk
about
it, but that's one of the reasons why it comes up so much. I mean, the immigration crisis, the refugee crisis is just horrendous. And can you say that that's a direct result in many cases? I mean, not when you're talking about people leaving Iraq, Afghanistan, and Syria is directly connected to the U.S. invasion?
Well, what I think one has to be careful about making the lines too straight and too simple. But I certainly would endorse the notion that the U.S. invasion of Iraq in 2003 shattered that country, and the shattering of that country has yielded a host of other negative consequences, one of which is the rise of the Islamic State. So yes, we made a mess of the place, and yes, we have, at a minimum, a moral obligation to try to do something to repair the damage that we have done. But I don't think that negates the larger point I was trying to make, that we have allowed ourselves to become preoccupied with a part of the world that is of less importance to our long-term well-being than other parts of the world and other issues.
Stephen, what would you say about President Obama wanting to pivot to Asia and then fully embrace the passage of the Trans-Pacific Partnership deal, which failed?
Yeah, I want to elaborate on the points that Andrew was making in a slightly different way. I mean, one of Obama's, I think, central problems, and you saw this at the very beginning, was he was trying to do too many things simultaneously. And he got better at that over time, but he still never, I think, fully understood that you had to set some pretty clear priorities. The key in Asia is that although there is a military component to the American role in Asia, we're going to be a military presence there for a while, it is far more of a diplomatic challenge for us than it is a military problem. The American military is still very capable. It is still more powerful than the Chinese military. What really needs to happen there, though, is some very sophisticated, coordinated, and attentive diplomacy partly with China to manage that relationship and keep it on as even a keel as possible, but more importantly, to manage a very complicated set of relations with our various friends and partners there. And here I'm talking about countries like Japan, South Korea, increasingly Vietnam, Philippines, where things are more delicate, India, Australia. This is a very large, geographically separated and complicated coalition to try and organize and lead if one is trying to sort of maintain a rough balance of power in Asia, which is, I think, what the United States wants to do. It is primarily a diplomatic task. It is not primarily a task of just getting more troops there, getting more ships there. And that means it takes time, lots of presidential attention, a willingness to go to the region a bit more often, and having the very best people in all the key positions here. And again, I'm thinking mostly on the diplomatic side, not...
Did we just lose Steve? I think something's wrong with his line. That is Steve Walt, Professor of International Affairs at the Harvard Kennedy School of Government. We're also joined today by Andrew Basevich, Professor of International Relations and History at Boston University. And today we are starting a week-long series looking at President Obama's legacy on a number of different issues. And today we're talking specifically about foreign policy and the powers that he will leave for Donald Trump. And you can join us at 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback at yourcallradio.org. And let's hear next from Ruthann in El Cerrito. Hi, Ruthann. Welcome to the show.
Good morning. I wanted to ask either guest what their thoughts were on the effects of Obama's foreign policy on the domestic policy of restricting and arresting and doing all such sorts of programs to affect domestic civil rights in terms of protests and different things, speech, action.
Okay, so the impact of his foreign policy on decisions curbing civil liberties, is that what you mean, Ruthann?
Wait.
Okay. Andrew, do you want to take that one?
Well, I mean, I think in the immediate aftermath of 9/11, in that sort of that period of fear and panic that swept the country, the George W. Bush administration overreached, in particular putting in place a set of programs to increase surveillance in ways that affected, that violated the privacy of the American people. And I think that the Obama administration curbed some of those tendencies. That said, we have moved into an era in which information technology makes it's a new surveillance regime that has come into existence, and I think has not yet resulted in a discussion of the privacy that we can now expect and should demand. And I think that that's one of the unanswered questions that Obama bequeaths to his successor. Unfortunately, he's bequeathing that question to a successor who probably has zero interest in the issue whatsoever.
Steve, I'm not sure if you heard our last caller, Ruthann, but she wanted to talk about civil liberties. And Glenn Greenwald wrote a piece in the Washington Post called "Donald Trump Will Have Vast Powers, and He Can Thank Democrats for Them." Glenn Greenwald writes that Obama detained terrorism suspects without due process, proposed new frameworks to keep them locked up without trial, targeted thousands of individuals, including a U.S. citizen, for execution by drone, invoked secrecy doctrines to shield torture and eavesdropping programs, and then also aggressively expanded the system of mass surveillance, including on U.S. soil, that had been secretly implemented by the NSA after 9/11. So what are your thoughts on his civil liberties record? And then here's the important question also, what he's leaving for Donald Trump.
Yeah, well, I think, Andy, I did catch the end of Andy's response, and I think that's basically right. I mean, Obama did make some modest efforts to try and rein in the worst excesses of the counterterror regime, but he did a number of other things, or allowed a number of other things to happen, because that was convenient for him. And I think many Democrats went along with it because, of course, you know, it was Barack Obama, and we all liked him, and things like that, and we didn't think he would really abuse it. The one other thing, of course, the Obama administration did was that they were very aggressive in going after whistleblowers and, in some cases, journalists, more aggressive than some of their predecessors had been. So it's not just the precedent of surveillance and things like that, an intelligence community that may be somewhat out of control, but it's also the use of the federal government's power to try and intimidate journalists. Now, what's interesting, of course, is Trump is going to become president and is already, in some respects, at war with the intelligence community in ways that Obama never was. Obama basically let the intelligence community do pretty much what it wanted. And it's not clear yet whether Trump will be quite as tolerant, I guess, if you see the exchanges they've had so far. At the same time, I think it's clear Trump is going to be very hard-nosed in dealing with the press, very dismissive of regular media in a variety of ways. But I think we're actually moving into an environment where the American people are going to have a great deal of difficulty figuring out what is true and what isn't. And that's not a healthy situation for any democracy, because democratic deliberation depends on reasonably accurate information, on people knowing what's going on and having some ability to tell when they're being lied to. And I think, you know, we have a president-elect whose entire career, in some respects, has been based on deception and deceit, and ran for president, telling an awful lot of lies along the way. And the lack of confidence people now have in the checks and balances and the scrutiny of the press, I think, does not leave us in a very good situation.
And we're going to talk about that very issue on Friday's show. Before we go to our next caller, Andrew, how are you processing what Obama is leaving for Donald Trump? What concerns you the most?
Well, I think one of the things that concerns me, and here it's not so much Obama's fault, but it reflects the abdication of the Congress with regard to war powers. You know, here we are a decade and a half after 9/11. We continue to be involved in wars that were initiated in response to 9/11, but we're also engaged in various other hostilities where the adversary has had nothing to do with 9/11. So, in effect, the Congress has allowed the presidency to claim an expansion of war powers. For all practical purposes, the president can initiate an attack on virtually anybody he wants to, as long as he can make some semi-plausible connection to terrorism. I didn't like that during the Obama era, and I greatly fear that as Mr. Trump becomes our president. That's a problem. But again, it's a problem that Obama didn't create. If you're looking for somebody to blame for that problem, it's our cowardly Congress. Mm.
Well, thank you for the question, Ruthann. Let's go next to Greg in Palo Alto. Hi, Greg. Welcome to the show.
Hello. There are two areas that I wanted to ask your guests a question about. One has to do with defense spending. The other has to do with arms sales. And what I'm concerned about is this. If the President of the United States, whether it's Obama or anybody else, is either captive to the military-industrial complex in this country and can't make decisions to, like, cut defense spending, not sell arms to Saudi Arabia, et cetera, then it seems to me there's no president that's going to be able to make changes in those areas. So if that's the case, that's surprising. But I think there's a possible understanding of this that came in the hearings when Elizabeth Warren was questioning potentially Defense Secretary, I think it was Mattis, and she was asking him questions about whether or not programs in her state, military programs in her state, research, etc., were going to be affected by his policies in the future. So if these people are so captive to this, there isn't going to be any change. Who's going to promote the change?
Well, I mentioned the $600 billion military bill that was passed overwhelmingly last month, and then President Obama's arms sales more than doubled George W. Bush's. This got a lot of attention. Sales to Saudi Arabia topped $115 billion, and then overall sales were about $278 billion. Andrew, what about that, the question Greg just asked?
Well, I don't know that presidents are captive, but there are a variety of forces that converge that promote ever greater arms sales. Certainly, attending to the well-being of the military-industrial complex, making sure that your constituents are satisfied by getting their share of defense contracts, placating the Israel lobby by providing generous support for Israel, basically trying to placate the government, the Saudi royal family, by selling them weapons in exchange for which we hope Saudi Arabia will have a more tolerant attitude toward the Iran nuclear deal. So there's a variety of things I think that work together in odd ways to promote weapon sales. There is very little serious discussion about whether the longer-term implications of us being the world's number one arms merchant actually lead to benefit the U.S. national security.
Hmm. Stephen, we have about a minute left. Your thoughts?
Well, first of all, I don't think you can expect our next president to crack down on any of those things. He's, probably going to be as pro-business a president as we've ever seen, and so I don't expect him to do anything that would limit the ability of American companies to sell weapons overseas. The one possibility is that, Trump may be immune from many things, but he's not immune to certain basic laws of accounting. And he can't, I think, simultaneously give Americans a big tax cut, particularly wealthy Americans a big tax cut, do a big infrastructure plan, and do a big defense increase. If he does all of those things, he blows the budget badly, he brings inflation back, the U.S. dollar goes up even more, etc. So he will, in fact, have to make some choices or there will be consequences. Unfortunately, the consequences in the short term are going to be mostly felt by poorer Americans, mm-hmm. and not by people who run defense companies. And we're going to just simply have to see how this plays itself out once he's finally in office.
Well, he's going to be in office soon, and he'll have to make some very important decisions over the coming months, and we'd love to have you both back to talk about that. Steve Walt is professor of international affairs at the Harvard Kennedy School of Government and co-author of The Israel Lobby and U.S. Foreign Policy. Andrew Basevich is professor of international relations and history at Boston University. His latest book is America's War for the Greater Middle East, A Military History. Steve and Andrew, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. And coming up on tomorrow's Your Call, we will continue our week-long series looking at President Obama's legacy by focusing on the economy and the 2008 financial crisis. The administration responded with a $700 billion bailout for Wall Street, while 9 million families lost property as a result of the housing bubble. So how did President Obama address the crisis and its effects, and what is he leaving for Donald Trump? You can join us tomorrow at 10 a.m. Your Call is produced here at KALW. Malihe Razazan and Alina Murphy produced today's show. Stephanie Porcel is our volunteer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer, and Kevin Vance is our studio engineer. You can email us with your feedback, and if you have any show ideas, feedback@yourcallradio.org. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call. Thanks for listening.